If it's nerdy, we're into it.
Gaming, movies, television, wrestling, comics, whatever. We are Kyle Eckert and Chris Heck, two lifelong friends with a passion for the world of geekery.
And this is the Geek Ketchup Podcast.
Welcome back, Geek Ketchup family. I'm Chris Heck.
And I'm Kyle Eckert.
It is still season two, and this is chapter 34. Today, we're heading back into the world of comics, and specifically, back into the world of Die. But before we get started, we both want to send a big thank you to everyone for listening to the show, and share that we truly appreciate you choosing to spend your time with us. If you've enjoyed Geek Ketchup, then be sure to hit the subscribe button so you never miss a chapter, and leave us a review to let us know how you think we're doing. You can also find us on social media to get updates on the show and content from the world of geekery. Geek Ketchup Podcast on Facebook and YouTube, at Geek Ketchup Pod on Instagram and Twitter. And you can find links to all of these accounts in the show notes below and on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. There's even links to our Patreon page and PayPal if you'd like to support the show, but the absolute best thing you can do is simply share Geek Ketchup with your friends and family. Published by Image Comics, Die first hit the shelves in December of 2018, but recently concluded its third volume. It's a horror-slash-fantasy that comes from the twisted mind of writer Kieran Gillen and truly brought to life by the spectacular artist Stephanie Hans. The story follows the journey of six friends who get trapped in the world of Die as 16-year-olds, then escape, and then find themselves getting transported and trapped again nearly 30 years later. Think of it as goth Jumanji with a touch of Stephen King's It, set in a Dungeons & Dragons environment. And speaking of D&D, a few months ago we announced that after being lifelong geeks, we were finally breaking into the world of tabletop RPGs. We've been able to have several sessions since that announcement, and so we thought before we get into the details of the latest Die story arc, this would be the perfect opportunity to bring you an update on Kyle and I's own Dungeons & Dragons adventure. So Kyle, when we first mentioned D&D on this show, we were literally brand new with barely one session under our belts. Now that we've played a few times, has your opinion on D&D changed?
It has not changed. I think you're right. Maybe we had played one time the night before even. And I said at that time, it was all like super geeky and really overwhelming. And even a couple sessions later, I'm kind of the same like mentality on it. Still nerding out hardcore about everything. But also there are these moments where I still feel incredibly overwhelmed by just the size of it all and trying to interact with NPCs and interacting with your fellow party members, also trying to figure out your way as your own character, both as a race and a class and interacting. Like, I'm having a ton of fun with it, but I do have these moments, and they're usually outside of the sessions when I'm trying to prepare for next steps or what I'm going to expect when I level up, that I just get really overwhelmed and I don't know which direction to go.
Yeah, I can totally understand that, totally relate to that. There just is a lot. And you think about the world of video games versus the world of D&D. You know, most video games are just taking certain slices out of the entire fantasy RPG world. And they kind of set up some boundaries. They set up some guardrails and, you know, push you along in the direction they want you to. And D&D is quite the opposite, where, you know, almost anything can be done. Every person can be talked to. You can be as thorough as you want or as shallow as you want. And you know, you really have to kind of focus in and figure out what you want to do. But like you said, I think our group is definitely maturing, even though we still are only, you know, what, four, five, six sessions in now.
Yeah, that's very limited.
Right, but we've had some opportunities to experience, you know, searching a town and seeking out side quests and interacting with NPCs of different backgrounds and motivations. And then, of course, we've had some really good combat here already, at least for us at, you know, level two.
Right.
We've had a few opportunities to get into some decent fights, especially in one of our recent sessions, taking on an entire group of orcs, a war chief, and an ogre. and it damn near killed us.
Yeah, that part was a little scary. Of course, you know, we went and we did it, and we realized kind of after we had done it that maybe we weren't fully prepared for it, but the roles were with us that night, or more accurately, the roles were with Medrash, you know, our Dragonborn Ranger that's in the group. He got lucky on several occasions not to be smashed by a tree.
Yeah.
We kind of all realized that if he had taken any one of those hits, he'd be done.
Yeah, I was so tense during that fight. And I know the way it worked out was your character and our other buddy Fargrim, you know, were up towards the front of the lines holding off the orcs a little bit. And then my character and Medrash were a little bit more turned and dealing with the ogre. And I just kept missing spells and you know, just every time I would miss a spell because I knew that ogre was coming, his attack was coming next. I was like, oh my God, we're going to lose Medrash.
Yeah.
It's going to happen. And yet somehow, you know, the rules were just with him and he just kept dodging.
Yeah.
He was like a ninja. I mean, just boom, boom, boom. And four or five big ogre attacks completely missed. And so even though we were significantly damaged and everybody was one hit away from death, we were able to survive and walk out of there and turn the quest in.
Oh, yeah. I think we immediately, you know, cleared out the cave and then sat down on the campfire and it's like, all right, let's take a long rest, like secure the environment and take that long rest. Everybody get their health back because we were in desperate need of it. And really thinking back on that specific fight, it is kind of funny because I was over on the side with our, you know, with Fargrim, who is a dwarf barbarian, and we were holding off the orcs, and you were over with Medrash. You and I were having similar roles where we just couldn't hit attacks.
Right.
But Fargrim and Medrash were hitting attacks because Fargrim was going kind of ape on the war chief.
Yeah.
You know, he had his dual blades out. And
he was raged, man.
He was raged out. Yeah. He had activated rage. You know, and was taking him head on, and I was just sitting there feeding him good berries as much as I could, healing him as much as I could.
Right.
You know, because I have taken on that full on embrace the healer life in the group, which has been pretty fun.
It's critical.
As a forest gnome druid and my character. So it's just, you know, we're going to have nights like that. And it was a learning experience. As soon as we were done, you know, in the session that we had after that, we kind of realized maybe we need to be a little more cautious as we head into some of these side quests and not take on too much. Think about what we're about to do.
Yes.
Because I think we got so excited.
Right.
They're like,
right.
Oh, orcs in a cave? Yeah, let's go do this. We can handle it. And it might be that video game mentality of, I can go in slightly underpowered and still be okay. But D&D is like a totally different monster in that realm.
Well, in some ways, you know, you can overcompensate for it in a video game with video game skill.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of get enough maturity and experience in video games that you know, okay, well, maybe I can go into this compromising situation, but sit back a little bit, try and pick them off or you know, tink their health down a little bit. So that way, when I actually go in, I can survive. You don't really quite get those same options in D&D because it really all comes down to the role.
Yeah.
Even though you can kind of plan or try to position yourself in different ways to your advantage, you know, it's still going to be about that D20 roll and whether or not you're going to hit or miss or, you know, do 1 point of damage versus big damage. And you know, I think just kind of coming to that realization and expectation, you know, will help temper us a little bit so that way we don't get wiped off the map before we hit level 5.
Right. Well, I think heading into that one, we had built our confidence because we had gone and we had done a goblin cave and, you know, fought through it with some success. And then we got to town, you know, we fought some Red Brand agents and once again had some success. So our confidence was high. And none of us stopped to think we are still level 2.
Right.
Like, we are still so low. And even in our last couple sessions, we're really close to level 3, but no one has eclipsed it yet. And really thinking that things are going to open up a little bit once we hit level 3 and probably go into these interactions with a bit more confidence. So it's striking that balance a little bit.
Right. It's been super cool. I know that I've immediately just I look forward to us playing so much, and I've gotten a few extra sessions in over you just simply because I did get pulled into a second group already where I created a new character, a Goliath barbarian over there. And so as I mentioned when we first talked D&D, my main character here for our core group is a high elf sorcerer. So definitely two different styles of gameplay, two different personalities. And that's been tough in a way, but also really good because it's giving me more opportunities to learn and learn what other characters can do and all of that. But I just look forward to it so much because we're doing it on video, we're using Discord. And even though we've had a history of playing, you know, online video games and things like that, I feel like the dynamics and really the connection is a lot closer here with what we're doing because of that video aspect of it. Whereas, you know, if we're just on the PlayStation, yeah, we're talking, but usually we are, you know, A, focused on the game, but you can't see each other, you can't read each other's body language and things like that. So it's just been good, especially after the last year with minimal contact with other people.
Now, I agree, and the video does help tremendously with that nonverbal communication, you know, being able to see people laugh and smile, and you do something goofy, or you say something in your character's accent, you have an interaction, you know, everyone just kind of smirks a little bit or gives you that pop, and it does, it takes it to the next level, and an extra dimension to it of having some fun and interacting with your friends. I think you kind of nailed it, too. With the past year, with limited in-person contact, it is nice to see your friends, have a laugh, you know, and enjoy yourself. So, you know, shout out to Discord for providing us that service.
Discord's been great. I hadn't used it too much before we started doing this, but I've really enjoyed it. It's kind of all in one, right? And makes it very easy to share information and then get on and chat. But I just love, I mean, I feel like every single night we get on, we have so many big laughs.
Yeah.
And it's just so, I guess, like cathartic or therapeutic in a way, when everything else in the world right now is so serious. But it's just like, I feel like most of the time, and it gets serious, of course, when we're in the adventure, but you just never know what people are going to do, what they're going to throw out, and the jokes that come out, you know, and the NPC interactions sometimes get really goofy. So it's just been really top-notch, I feel like, across the board, even though we probably still have so much to learn or so much more that we could do.
Yeah.
We're still in our infancy, but man, I'm hooked.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have to temper myself because you got invited to that second group and went all in. I actually, you know, also got invited to do that second group and actually said, no, I want to make sure that this first group has all of my attention and I'm into it. And now there's a part of me that is regretting saying no a little bit because it's created just this urge. I just want to play every weekend. It is because it's so much fun. Just kind of, you know, forget about everything for a while, play a different character, be goofy, break outside of yourself, or bring some of your personality into your character. I think that definitely shows in my character, Amaret. There's a lot of me in him, in the certain ways I interact with people. But it just, yeah, I don't want to call it an addiction. That is such a strong word, but yeah, the claws are sinking in on how much fun I'm having and how much more I want to experience with it.
For sure. Yeah. Talking about like your personalities, I think that's definitely how I set up Valcian, you know, the first character, the high elf, just cause it was a little bit easier, a little bit more simple, keeping it in line with characters that I typically build in video games that I'm familiar with. So when I went to the second group, there was a part of me that thought, because we're new, oh, I'll keep the same character and just play him in two different groups just to keep getting more familiar with sorcerers and all of that. But I ultimately decided to go totally different with the Goliath and the barbarian, and I do play him a little bit more abnormal to how I am.
Yeah.
And is way more goofy about it, you know, and so it's been fun, and I can see as we go through, right? So if we stay with our group and we get through this adventure and these characters and we start getting to a point where we start creating new characters, I think it'll also be really fun because that experience, even that little bit of experience that we initially got, I felt like really added to how I built my second character. And I expect that'll just get more and more as we go, and the immersion will just become deeper.
For sure, for sure. I found a similar experience as I wrote my character's backstory a little bit and kind of fleshed that out, because I realized I needed to start introducing people into his backstory and how he came to be where he is and this and that. So as I've developed those characters, I've found like, oh, well, this makes me want to make a character like this that acts like that. I know our good buddy told us about a group that he's in where somebody's son is playing a barbarian but thinks he's a wizard and so like, and it got my, you know, the gears turning in my head of how much fun you could really have with various characters that are unaware of themselves or highly aware of themselves in either way,
right?
And it does, the immersion is the best way to put it. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, and that's kind of something I picked up a lot on with Critical Role that we've been watching lately on YouTube, you know, because I was introduced to that after creating Valcian.
Mm-hmm.
And so seeing how they approach characters and how much goofier they are, and, you know, they're kind of intertwined between the fantasy characters of D&D and other, you know, elements maybe from real life, thinking about Caleb from the Mighty Nein campaign. You know, he's a wizard, but he wears like the shoulder straps, like a gun.
Yeah.
You know, where you would have a gun under a jacket, but that's where he keeps his spell books. You know, and just like little things like that that are like, oh man, that really sets it off, kind of makes it unique and original. And I don't think my mind was really there at first. You know, I'm trying to like play within these rules and build a character, but you know, very kind of tightly within what the book is giving you and all of that preconceived notions of Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
And then you see like what Critical Role does, and they're next level, right? They're voice actors and everything, but just seeing the freedoms that they take and how they bring them to life made all the difference when I went and created, you know, Hammer Time, my Goliath barbarian. And, like, that was one of those things, you know, I was like, oh, I want to use a giant warhammer, kind of do this Robert Baratheon, Braun Strowman hybrid kind of a character, you know? And
right.
But I was like, let me give some comedy here, and since Goliaths tend to be a little bit more simple, and they all have nicknames, I was like, oh, you know, Hammer Time.
Just Hammer Time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's pretty good. No, and I'm with you, and I think some of that comes from our experience with video games, and I was actually thinking this more along the lines as we develop our characters and level up and get new abilities, but it actually also makes sense in a way of, you know, developing personalities and outfits and things of that nature. Sometimes in video games, you get freedom, but it's still very guided.
Right.
And like you said earlier with the guardrails, like, you know, yes, you can be this or be that, but, you know, once you select that, then you only get these options to break off of.
Yeah.
And in D&D, it's totally open. You know, you can be that Goliath barbarian and be a bit of an oaf and maybe simple, but who knows, maybe you dress nicely,
right,
or something.
Yeah.
You know, you get those freedoms to be, you know, however you want to be, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we could definitely talk our own Dungeons and Dragons probably all day. But we are here to talk about another Dungeons & Dragons-esque storyline that we have been following for a little while now and recently caught up on the most recent story arc, the third arc. So, as we mentioned at the beginning, that is with Die, the Image Comics. And just over 2 years ago, Kieran Gillen and Stephanie Hans introduced us to this world-bending realm. And they took us on a journey to a mysterious, hyper-gothic setting that's filled with knights, neos, godbinders, fools, and dictators, along with all of the other fantasy-type creatures and beasts that you can think of. So looking back in the first story arc, which was titled Fantasy Heartbreaker, readers are introduced to the group of five, which is Ash, the party leader and the dictator who has the ability to influence and control others by the use of spoken spells, Angela, his younger sister, who plays a cyberpunk-styled Neo, and then the emotion knight that is Matthew, who uses his depression to fuel his own abilities. And then there's Isabel the Godbinder. Isabel's character trades offerings with the different gods throughout the Realm of Dai to gain advantages. And then rounding out the rest of the group is Chuck the Fool and Solomon, who is Ash's best friend when they were younger, but was ultimately left behind when the group escaped the Realm of Dai during their first journey. So tight-knit group of friends, kind of sucked in Jumanji style into an evil world. They left, and then they were brought back, and that is essentially where the initial story arc started off when we were first introduced to Dai.
So the interesting thing about Saul, or Solomon, is that he actually plays as a master or grandmaster, and in this kind of unique world of Dai RPG, the DM or game master is also a player in the game. And after realizing that their friend is the one in control, the party actually slays Saul in hopes that it would return them home, you know, on the second trip to Dai. However, it has adverse effects and turns him into a fallen, which is a being, like a zombie-like being that only has one drive, and it's to haunt the living players caught in Dai. Then that brings us to a close of the first story arc, and the second one starts off and starts to develop some of the finer details of the world. It becomes more clear how it came to be, who else is trapped there, and then the lasting effects that the group's first trip had on the overall world. They realize that there was a larger game being played, and in that second story arc, they divided the group up because they decided that, you know, they couldn't come to a decision on the best course of action.
Right, yeah. Some want to simply return home while others feel responsible for the wreckage they've caused. And Split the Party, as the arc is named, took readers deeper into each character and expanded on what else can be found in Dai. But in the end, after several betrayals and revelations, the arc concluded with Ash ascending to the throne as Queen of Angria, holding the fate of the party and the entire realm in her hands. So that brings us to issue 11, which kicks off the third volume that we are going to be chatting about today. And so in this issue, the great game picks up by slowing us back down a bit after the events in Glasstown and gives us a much deeper insight into the party members' psyche and their standing, you know, after these big events have happened. So in issue 11, a little bit of a high level, we see that Angela, Matt, and Chuck are on the run with two dwarven NPCs that I absolutely love. They've got great personality, and they have this weird kind of yin and yang type deal going on. And we see them kind of leaving the area while Ash is in the Palace of Angria struggling with what she has done. Her place as queen is in question, and her relationship with her best friend, Saul, who we just learned is being held in the bowels of the palace. So while it's a slower issue, there's a lot being developed right out of the gate here. And, you know, both parties seem to be searching for answers as to what to do next. Both seem to be emotionally fractured by what they've done to the world of Dai and to each other.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's really testing all of their moral compasses and their bonds. And I think also we really kind of see that both know that there is just really, really imminent danger coming as enemy forces are looking to move on them.
Yeah, it's very much a building block styled issue where, you know, it sets in motion. This is what happened at the end of the second story arc, and here's where we're going in this third one. And one of the best parts of Dai, I think, are this the deconstruction of the various characters, and then also how they compare to their real life selves.
Right, yep.
Because, you know, when they were 16 and they first got sucked into Dai, they brought a lot of their teenage self into the world and into their character. And then upon escaping and trying to leave that behind, trying to kind of forget that Dai ever happened, and when they come back 30 years later, they're immediately put back into those, like, teenage bodies. in a way, and having to look at themselves in the mirror. And this kind of continues that tone of realizing what you did to this world and that lasting effect and how to make it right. And it's something that carries over through all of Die, but is very much shown here in this building block issue for me.
Yeah, in the beginning, you can tell when they came the first time that, kind of to your point, those teenage years, right, they didn't really care too much about what they were doing. They were selfish. It was about what they wanted to do and experience and, you know, how they could get home. And now, you know, all this time later in the real world, they have kids, they've got wives and husbands and relationships and all sorts of different things that have come to them. So they've grown.
Yeah.
And we saw that really, I think, in the second story arc as to why the party got split, because some seem to fall back into those old tropes of where what it was like when they first came and where they were kind of masters of their domain in a way, you know, kind of do whatever they want. And now, you know, others are, I think, a little bit more in tune with the moral aspects of it. They see the folks in Die as more real people maybe than they did originally. And so they know that the actions they take really have some consequences to them versus this just being a game.
Oh, yeah. Well, and they also start to realize at the tail end, I think it was probably issue 10, where they come across Charlotte Bronte.
Right.
The writer, and they start to realize that the worlds are blended more than they thought they were.
Yes, yeah.
And that there are possibly, you know, unconfirmed at this point, but possibly other living people from their world making their way to Die. And it just, it kind of kicks off a lot of what we see here in this volume of, yeah, you're right, some people, this place isn't real, let's go home. And then other people are, this place might be more real than we think it is. We shouldn't just leave it in shambles.
Right.
It was awesome. And the whole book just continues to develop those characters, develop those feelings, which is just really cool. But at the exact same time, being an RPG-styled book, you do want a little bit of action. And you get it here and there. But, you know, the core of this entire story, and especially this one, is build that story and the dichotomy between the different characters.
Yeah, and I really liked what we got from the substance of issue 11 and, you know, just the emotions and the turmoil and, you know, kind of that look into each of the different characters and kind of where they're at right now, the politics of the land. You know, I really enjoyed all of that, even though this issue was much slower than I expected it to be, because so far, I think for the most part, the Die series has picked up, you know, almost immediately from the events of one issue into the start of the next.
Yeah.
And so coming out of what we got at the end of Arc 2, I kind of just expected it to be almost like balls to the wall from the get-go.
Yeah.
And even though there is a lot going on and you can feel a lot of these events are kind of really picking up in their own way, the issue itself kind of took it back to the more individual level in a way, and we get to see that Ash is struggling with what she's done and, you know, being queen and the fact that her friends, you know, Chuck, Matt, and Angela have pretty much left the coop, you know, done with her. And it all kind of got redeemed a bit when we find out that Saul is in the basement.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've got him trapped. He looks like he's in like a glass bell.
Like a bird cage. I saw that as like a little bird cage.
That's a good
thing.
One too. Yeah, bird cage. And we get some really cool interactions between them where it's not so much about the great game. It's more about them and their relationship because they were, you know, as tight as you and I are in the real world from what they've set up in the story. And it's, you know, awkward, it's tense, neither of them are truly comfortable with it. And they set up this really kind of dramatic scene. And then I found it funny because it's the moment where it's broke and Saul asks Ash about what Nirvana's follow-up albums were like.
Yeah.
And like, you know, after all this turmoil, all these years and Die, kind of the first thing Saul wants to know is like, dude, what happened to Nirvana?
Yeah, right. And poor Ash had to break it to him about Kurt Cobain in 1994.
Yeah.
But to that exact point, that is one of my favorite moments, is that Ash goes down and starts having this conversation with Saul. And through the course of the conversation, you get a little inner monologue on Ash's side. And she realizes that after all of these years, Saul is still her best friend.
Yeah, he's still in there.
Yeah, Ash and Saul still just good buddies. And I think there really is a moment where Ash recognizes how much, how much she's missed Saul.
Yeah.
Like, as a friend and, as a part of her life. And it really is. It just deepens the character that much more to me.
And they do this across the board. It's one of the underlying things about this series that has hooked me. And I think I may have mentioned it when we first talked about this with the characters and somebody like Ash, who, you know, is a male in the real world on Earth, but comes to the fantasy world as a female, living it out, you know, has had a child and kind of everything that goes with it, and just the inner turmoils being highlighted there that a lot of real people go through in the actual world, but putting it into these characters in such a way that creates that drama, creates that tension, creates that pool, that emotional pool where you can see them going back and forth with their desires and what they think they should be doing. Also in this issue, we caught that with Angela.
Yeah.
And they're on their own path, as I said, with Chuck and Matt, and they're fighting some fallen. And then all of a sudden, she realizes that one of the fallen is her daughter.
Right, yeah, her daughter Molly.
And that was kind of a cool twist, because it started to force her immediately to, like, reconcile or deal with kind of her own struggles. And was she a good mom? How could this have happened to my daughter? And I don't know, it's like, it's not even top tier while we're here for the books, but there's just all these moments like that peppered through that you realize, like, there is a lot being said in this dialogue and in this story.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of what we talked about earlier with our D&D adventure. You know, you go on these journeys to either play out somebody completely different than yourself, or, you know, you pepper in actual aspects of your own character into your role there. And in this case, like, that's maybe something Angela, she was going originally as a teenager just to play this Neo, this cyberpunk, to have fun. And now she's returned back as an adult, and she's finding so much of her actual life in the world of Dai, and it's putting it right in her face and showing her, you know, was she a good mom? Is she doing the right thing? And it starts, like I said, you know, they're constantly blurring the lines of what's right, what's wrong, and, you know, different parts of your character, and you can't always escape things the way you would like to.
Right, yeah. Fantasy and reality are very much blended, more than anybody wants to admit, I think.
Yeah. Well, and we see that across the board with the best fantasy stories out there are ones that have real human elements underneath of them all.
Right.
Like, you know, it's hard not to reference it, but the early stages of Game of Thrones, that was the best part. I think, you know, Ben Wyatt from Parks and Rec says it best. It's human stories told in a fantasy setting. Like, yeah, and that's what makes, I mean, good human stories is what makes any story really good.
That's
and
true.
The environment becomes second in some cases, or just a booster to that.
Creates those connections between the fan and the character.
Yeah, it's not always what you want. Like, sometimes you really do just want to totally escape and see something out, you know, totally off the wall. But in other times, it's nice to see a little bit of your own human reflection in your stories.
Yeah, because it gets you thinking. And I know that's something that I always appreciate. And it doesn't have to always be so action-packed. So it's more cerebral,
yeah,
in a way, you know, forcing you to look inside as well, who you relate to, who you don't, and why that may be. But moving on here from issue 11 into issue 12, you know, they really kept it going, and it was still a bit of a setup. We were still in that moment where they're kind of shifting and setting up the pieces for what is going to be the next real happenings of the Dai world here. And so we get a lot of focus on the fallout from Angela finding her daughter and kind of the emotional tailspin that kind of puts her in with Molly as a Fallen. And then we also see a new presence introduced when Ash is confronted back in Angria by an envoy for a group of people called Little England, who pretty much lets her know that they are declaring war on her for what they did to Glasstown. And that was a really cool moment with this weird kind of bug-like envoy, and he delivers the message and then just like melts away and dies right in front of her.
Yeah, and I think they point out that they purposefully planted it that way because they wanted a creature to go in that couldn't be controlled by a dictator.
Yes.
Which is Ash's styled character. And Angria also has tons of dictators. Ash isn't the only one that can control a single person by spoken word. So they wanted to send the envoy, deliver the message, and then make sure that, you know, that person dies instantly so they can't leak any extra secrets.
Right. And so from there, we get really filled in on Isabel's relationships with some of the gods that she leverages. And both sides of the party are progressing their plan or their adventure further as they are continuing to figure out how to achieve their respective goals and deal with the issues that they have. Ultimately, it ended on a pretty good cliffhanger, even though, like I said, it was a touch of a slower issue, as we see Ash secretly meeting with a character named Herbert George Wells, who we learn came to die from Earth as well.
Yeah, we start to, a lot of this issue, it really breaks down and reminds you that they're playing a game.
Yes.
And that they start to remind you of the rules and concepts and structures of the world of Dai and how they relate to Dungeons & Dragons and other tabletop role-playing games like that. And it's super cool. And then, you know, the twist right there at the end with H.G. Wells showing up, because, you know, you find out that the world of Dai is one big D20. And each flat side is its own unique culture and civilization, and each side is also controlled by a master. And what you start to find out is each master, you know, rules over their domain, and they're all very unique in how they interact with that environment. I think in one of the earlier issues, we saw somebody that resembled J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah.
But they didn't, you know, it was never confirmed.
No.
They just kind of heavily hinted that that's who it was. And so now we're starting to see these famous writers and, you know, Charlotte Bronte, also, you know, classic literature writer, coming in, and they've been involved in this creation of the world. And so the reveal of H.G. Wells as one of the masters of the domains was like, oh man, like it was perfect parts, like great for the story, great for the world, and like amazing Easter egg cameo.
Yeah, I am a huge sucker for alternate history stories.
Yeah.
And so anytime you pull in real life people like this and then give them this entire new twist on what they were actually doing or what they could have been doing, I just pop. Like, I love it.
Yeah.
And so seeing him here and then really kind of getting that understanding that there really are more grandmasters out there. And I have to be honest, I don't know if I fully grasped before the moments with Wells that there were so many more grandmasters. Like in the first two story arcs, so much more of the focus is on Saul being grandmaster. And so I was kind of under the impression that it's like there's one grandmaster really controlling the whole world at a time, almost, you know, something like that. And I don't know if it was maybe they just didn't truly let on to it or talk about it as much as we saw in the third arc here, or if I just missed it. But like, that was actually a moment where I was like, whoa, you know, there's all these other grandmasters, because Wells starts talking about Saul and he mentions, I think, you know, not by name per se, but some of the others, as you said, like, oh, these guys play by the rules or these guys don't. And it's just like this whole other layer of the hierarchy and kind of the interactions that could be seen, I guess, as we move along, that started to open up in my mind.
Yeah, I think they kind of surface level hit it, but in the early days, it was all about Saul. because what they said when they left him behind, he had continued to play the game and went from being a master to the grandmaster. And like, that's kind of the structure, is that each little area has a master that rules the domain.
Okay.
But at level, you know, on that the 20, sense. There is a grandmaster that controls everything. And Saul took the role of grandmaster over all the domains.
That might be where I was a little mistaken, was the difference between master and grandmaster. Okay.
Yeah. But this opened up a world, because, you know, this issue, and as that conversation continues into the next issue with H.G. Wells, I'm like, well, who else are they going to introduce down the line as a potential master? Like, what other, you know, classical literature writers or pop culture influences are we going to see come out?
Right.
Because each of these different worlds is so different and draws from that piece of history.
Agreed. Yeah. And before we go to issue 13, there was one other thing I thought that was really worth calling out here in issue 2. And it was almost easily to overlook. And I remember when I first read it, I was like, oh, damn. But then by the time I had come back in preparation for a breakdown here, I was like, oh, crap, that happened. And I almost like forgot about it, even though it seemed like a kind of a juicy nugget. At some point in issue 12 here, Angela, Chuck, and Matt learn that the toy soldiers that we learned about in Arc 2 as being kind of part of what started all of this stuff with Di and Charlotte and her family, we learn that they were actually crafted by Saul.
Yeah.
And sent over. And so I know it kind of becomes a joke as we go through with like all the different timeline stuff that's going on, but like that was actually a pretty big revelation that there's some real wonkiness going on with the timeline as far as what happens right now versus, you know, when they came into the world and the history, because we're talking history of like 150 years when you're looking at some of these characters like a Wells or whoever that are being involved, and yet the party that we're familiar with first came to die in, what, the 90s? And then back in, you know, 2020? So, craziness going on.
I think, yeah, they originally came in 1991. And at the time of the book, it's 2018. And then going into 2019, because...
That's it, you know, yeah.
We'll get there. I think 2020 ends up becoming a factor.
Right, right.
To your point, yeah, it becomes very circular. The whole timeline becomes very circular, and it becomes very Terminator.
Yeah.
Where the, you know, at the end is the beginning, and Saul creating the toy soldiers, which then are given to the Bronte children who ultimately create Di. Yeah, it just creates this like circle of happenings where, you know, your ending is your beginning type deal. And,
right,
you know, for everything to exist, it has to continue to go in motion.
Yeah. So issue 11 and 12 wrap up, and we can definitely see some of the beginnings of where we're going. We're getting new information. And then I will tell you, man, I thought that issue 13 is where stuff really started to pick up. And I really got excited from here on out, because issue 13 picked up right where issue 12 left off with the conversation between Wells and Ash. And it pretty much kind of starts us down this path of getting a lot more detail out of Wells. But at the same time, it also is shifting back and forth to Angela, Matt, and Chuck. And they are showing us essentially some new lands that they are exploring on their adventure. And they take us to the land of the Grandmaster for the first time, I think, which is on that natural 20 side of the D20. You know, it is D20. And it's here that we get some great Grief Knight action for the first time in this arc. We're also introduced to the Fair, which were kind of weird, giant, floating, sentient-type beings that seem to know the outcomes or maybe the future. Like, they're more omnipresent, it seems like. And
I think we had been introduced to the Fair once before.
On that level?
Yeah, like, Angela, you knew that Angela went to talk to them. To get but it was very brief. Like, the conversation that happened here was much longer than the conversation that happened back in a couple issues ago.
Yeah, okay, yep. Yeah, we're actually seeing them. There's two of them, and it's a multi-page part of this story here.
Yeah.
And we kind of get a much better feel for what these creatures are, what they can do. And even though there's definitely still a lot of mystery, but through their conversations with them, you know, we also learn more about the history of Dai. And that's where we get introduced to kind of what you alluded to with the whole 2020 year being significant, because it's the fair here that first released the information that the world of Dai is actually trying to merge with the world of Earth. And there could be a lot of bad consequences from that. And, you know, at the same time, literally, it was well done, right? Because you had these two very different paths being taken to learn generally the same information. Not quite.
Yeah.
But, you know, both of them are wrought with peril. Angela and Matt and them have to essentially fight through Fallen to talk to the Fair. And with Ash, we see that, you know, Wells kind of gets a little trickery, tries to turn the tables, maybe take her out before Isabel can intervene.
Issue 13 was a total game changer across the board, and it might be the biggest issue of the entire run so far.
Mm.
Because, like, all the secrets come spilling out through Ash's conversation with H.G. Wells, and you figure out, you know, how he came to be in power, why he came to be in power, his motivation. And you also find out, I think, pre that conversation that he doesn't like the fact that Ash is Queen of Angria and ruling that land.
Yeah.
Because that land is meant to be ruled by the NPC that, you know, I guess in Zamornia, the vampire, her husband.
Right. Yep.
And, you know, he doesn't like the fact that a human player is controlling an area. He believes that it should all be the NPCs. But, you know, like you said, we get the same information in two different ways for the two different groups. And you find out through H.G. Wells's conversation with Ash, you know, where things are headed and what they want to happen. And then in that conversation with Angela, Matt, and Chuck with the Fair, what the end goal is going to be. And you find out, keeping things very circular, that they're headed to the Forge in that 20-sided die, where the die that they were given as teenagers are being created.
Yes.
To kick off this whole thing. Like I said, it all starts to come back around. And this was an issue that you almost needed to read twice.
Yeah.
Because the conversation with H.G. Wells is a little confusing. And you really need to read through the lines and figure out what he's saying. And then also to understand the path that the other half of the group is on and where they're going. And it's, like I said, game changer. The issue 13, absolute game changer.
Well, and going back to what I was saying about loving alternate history type content, you know, that discussion with Wells where he's talking about, I forget the name of the other creator, but he talks about how there was this board game made, you know, that was all around war situations and kind of like a war simulation, but it was a tabletop RPG.
Yeah.
And how, you know, in a time of peace, like men being able to sit around and play this game and just constantly strategize, it actually led to, you know, armies, you know, getting better and be able to create more destruction and chaos. And so he had created, you know, his own version of a game that he thought would help save the world from that. And then ultimately he came to die. And so Ash had to break the news to him that, hey, you know, you think you're perfect. You think that your solution worked and you're some special god or whatever it may be, you know, and then kind of tears that down a little bit and lets him know that, you know, World War One and Two still happened.
So yeah, you didn't prevent that.
Yeah, you didn't prevent anything. And you've been over here in the world of Dai, like, oh, look at me, man, I'm special.
Yeah.
You know?
yeah, you're right. And it's interesting. I didn't think about it until right now, how Ash had to break the news to Saul about Nirvana.
Yeah.
And it was so upset to have to do it. And, but here to H.G. Wells, she's like, yeah, that didn't work out. Your book, Little Wars, didn't, because I think that was the book that
they
referenced.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah.
Your book, Little Wars, didn't go the way you thought it was going to go. And yeah, World War One and World War Two still happened.
Yeah.
And the Great War still went down.
Yeah, it was wild, and it still not a ton of action here, but just digging into the story and the lore, and also taking it to a much more significant level by letting us know really what the stakes are and the world's merging. You know, millions of people essentially are going to be dead on one side or the other, depending on if the die world essentially becomes the dominant world. So you had all of that, but then you also had some things peppered in, like the fair pretty much confirmed that the character Chuck, his days are probably numbered.
Yeah.
Because we knew that he had found out some health-related issues on the real world before they got pulled back into die in the Split the Party arc. But this kind of took it to another level, and he's trying to determine if there's anything that can be done to save him, and they pretty much tell him no.
Yeah.
So maybe they swerve us on that in the future, but that kind of seemed like pretty ominous, as, you know, one of these party members is going to truly, truly die.
Yeah, it isn't going to make it out of this. The intriguing part of the conversation with the fair was, you know, they got one question each. There were three players, three questions for Angela, Matt, and Chuck. And Chuck instantly comes out and asks his question. Matt uses his question for Chuck.
Right. Yes.
Which I thought, you know, was just a great move. You know, he could have asked anything under the sun. He could have asked about his family, his children. We do know that his father was sick when he got sucked back into die. He could have used that to ask anything, but instead, you know, he did what was best for his friend and asked a question on his behalf, which was, you know, just onions, man, onions.
Yeah, his moral compass is great, and he has those great moments like that. I thought, too, that there was one question kind of set up, I think, starting here, and then I think it gets mentioned a few times as we go through the last two issues of this arc. When they mention that essentially some sort of artificial intelligence or like autonomous intelligence is the one that started building the world of Dai.
Yeah.
And it's almost like some sort of higher power AI that is making a toy. And so they kind of mention that a little bit. They don't go too much in the details. We don't know a whole lot yet about this intelligence. But I thought that was interesting too, because my impressions or where I had come to believe so far from what they had given us was maybe that there was just like one grandmaster person that had somehow created this world. Or maybe from what the Charlotte, what's her last name? I always forget the last name.
Bronte.
The Brontes.
Yeah.
That her family had really been the ones to kind of dream up this world and somehow bring it to life. But it seems like there's actually another power to be that we're going to find out more about here at some point in the future.
Yeah, and that trickles along a lot here. Mm-hmm. Because everybody that thinks they have absolute power realizes that they don't, and somebody above them, and every person that has come to that revelation has not received it well.
No.
They realize that they think they are playing the game and realizing that they're just pieces of the game. And yeah, they all flip out. We see H.G. Wells flip out when he finds that out too.
Yeah, and it all comes back to the rules. And it's funny because we talked about, you know, with D&D, like there's so much going on. There's a lot to learn. You know, it's very much about the rules, even though you have a ton of freedom. And I thought it was just kind of funny to see, really, it was like a reminder to all of them. Like, hey, you know, you've gotten some leeway, but there are definitely still rules controlling everything here. And whether you think you are or not, you're still very much operating within them.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think of in our own, you know, particular game, we built up some confidence.
Yes.
We had slayed a few people, and we came across a character, I think it was Thrug, and somebody threatened him, and our DM casually mentioned, you're like, yeah, by the way, guys, you watched him totally decapitate a sorcerer that was handing you your butts.
Right,
so.
Right.
Maybe think about the larger game here. Think about the larger picture. You know, as confident as you four may be, you're not going to be able to take this guy. And it was like, ooh, yeah, there's that check.
Yeah.
you know, and these guys in Die, they're getting it. All the players are getting it.
And it kind of just leads us into issue 14 here, which just absolutely turns the volume up a good bit more. It takes us further into the conflict. And I mean, Die always has dark imagery, but the opening and kind of this whole book, but the opening pages of issue 14 just went even darker.
Yeah.
On the color tones, the imagery, and it also kind of opened up much more combat here. We see Ash sending her mind-controlled vampire husband, Zamorna, and her son, Augustus, off to lead, you know, the Angrian army into war. And we also get a chance to go back to the ruins of Glasstown with Angela, Chuck, and Matt. And, you know, you kind of just know shit's about to go down, you know, with these first few pages.
Yeah.
But there was also just a good bit of death, and you know, whether it was them killing NPCs or other things, but a lot of tension here as the story kind of changed in itself with all of that going on when Mistress Woe comes calling to Isabella and, you know, pretty much calls in that favor and makes her tell Matt that his father had died in the real world. And man, did that just set everything up for an explosive twist. I mean, when that happened, it was just like, holy crap.
Yeah.
What is about to happen? What is the finale of this book going to look like?
Yeah, you can always rely on Matt to give you those explosion moments because he is the knight of the group. You know, he's the one in the armor with the sword, kind of going ham when he needs to go ham. So you don't get too many action moments in Die. A lot of it is like that political thriller style where they're maneuvering pieces and, you know, character building and betrayal and things like that. But when you do get those high action moments, and Stephanie Hans's art is just silky smooth.
Yeah. We should call that out because we haven't this yet. We always talk about it, but man, it just still hitting it so well.
Oh yeah, and it's just like the blending of colors and the way that she does it, it just, none of it is fine detailed, but it's all very fitting for this fantasy styled realm, the flames and the heat, and just kind of colors going from one, you know, yellows to oranges to reds to black and things like that. It just, it looks so good.
Yeah, the color work is on point, but I think it's also the imagery. I mean, as good as the actual written story is here, there are just panels that are drawn in a way that just evoke what is happening. It just evokes emotion without saying a single word. And I don't read quite enough comics to make a statement as strong as it's the best out there. But I will say, for what I read, I think it's right up there at the top of what I have seen personally.
I think for me, it's always the art needs to match the story that's being told.
Sure.
And that's kind of, you know, how I judge the art on a book. And in this case, it's a perfect match.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know if this particular style would do well, you know, with X-Men or Batman or Captain America or something like that. I'm sure it would. I'm sure it would look fine, but would it perfectly match the story? I don't know.
Right.
But in this case, it absolutely does. And I'm like looking at a panel that you referenced. It's the opening panel of this particular issue. And you're right. The power of Ash standing next to Zamorna with Isabel right there, and they're at the center of stone, surrounded by their army. And it's nighttime, and there's, you know, candles and fires and things going on as this entire group of people prepare to march into Little England and go to war with them. And it's, you're right, like, it's so powerful and it matches so perfectly. Like, you hit the feels, like it just right in your gut. Like, you feel the pressure and the importance of this situation and all situations.
Right. Well, and in another way where the art was very powerful was when we go back to Glasstown, because when we are first introduced to Glasstown, it is beautiful. It's this, you know, very, I don't know, cathedral-like structure.
Yeah.
And it had a lot of brighter colors, obviously all the glass, and just looked like a testament to, you know, the society that lived there. And, of course, Ash and the party destroy it at the end of Arc 2. And so when we finally come back to it with Matt, Chuck, and Angela, you see it is dark and gray and devastated and, you know, none of the beauty and pristineness, you know, that was there when we first, so it just completely changed the whole view on that part of the map.
Yeah, what had been industrialized by the Prussian Empire.
That too, yep.
Yeah, so, you know, all of a sudden there's smog in the air and soot on the ground, and anything that was, you know, a shining beacon of light is now just dark and dusty and covered in metal and smoke. And, you know, there's a lot to be said there. I think there's probably some commentary on human interactions and taking over nature.
Right.
But it's still very powerful.
So ultimately, when we see, you know, as I said before, Mistress Wo come back in here, you know, this was truly kind of the key moment of this issue. For all that happened leading up to this part of the issue, tensions are high, there's battles going on, and then Mistress Wo just kind of pops in on Isabel and says, "Hey, girl, you know that favor you owed me? Time to collect. You know, I'm ready to get it." And
yeah,
pretty much gives her a task that she knows is going to be really bad.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought it was funny because she kind of reacts and, like, leaves kind of everything that's going on and goes and gets a glass of wine and is, like, kind of mulling it over for a few. Like, am I really going to do this? But doesn't have much of a choice. She's dealing with gods, and so she sends a little birdie off to let Matt know in the middle of his own fight, "Hey, your father's really dead, and you missed it."
Yeah, you missed it in the robe. And his emotion, because, like, I guess we're kind of skipping over the various moving parts of what's happening here. So, like, there's Angria, they're going to war with the Little Englanders, and then there's also the Prussian Empire that is setting up shop, you know, where Angela, Matt, and Chuck are going. And basically, Angria doesn't want to go to war with Little Englanders. You know, they want to work together against the Prussian Empire. You know, the enemy of your enemy is my friend,
right,
type situation. And so all these moving pieces are happening. There's a war happening on one front while the other group is trying to sneak into this Prussian area. And then all of a sudden, this message gets delivered. And Matt drops everything he's doing and was like, "Teleport me to where I need to go. I need to go get my revenge," because he's going to blame Ash and Isabella on the fact that they brought him here, they wouldn't allow him to leave, and now he has missed a significant moment in his real life.
Yeah, and we see him go from mostly driven by grief and sadness to just straight rage.
Yeah.
And I mean, the moment it happened, it literally, you're like, what is going to happen here? Because you see, he's pretty much unstoppable.
Yeah.
Between how the knights are set up and die, and then the weapons that they have, I mean, they are truly, truly formidable creatures, you know, and everybody fears them.
Yeah.
Kind of in the party, everybody else, I mean, they are highly respected in that regard. And so, yeah, you see him pretty much stop what he's doing, tells Angela to teleport him out of there, and she reluctantly does it. And, man, my mind blew apart when you see the last couple pages here, and he doesn't go straight back to Angria. He goes and gets another emotion weapon.
Oh, yeah. That panel where he goes to the temple or the order or wherever these, you know, emotion-driven knight's weapons are held and walks in and he picks up the Maul of Rage.
Yes.
And, like, and both his weapons are, you know, they have, like, a voice in his head and they speak to him and they, you know, fuel whatever emotion they are attached to.
Right.
And neither one of those weapons is willing to go with him. They're almost afraid of the you know, the wielder, which is a bit of a reversal because his sword is always trying to, you know, get one over on him and make him sad.
Egg him on.
And they're like, no knight has ever done this. This breaks the rules. You're not allowed to wield two of us. You only have to be one. But his, you know, his anger and his sadness over the loss of his father is enough that he takes controls of the weapons.
Yeah.
And the weapons don't control him. Yeah. And when he lights up,
dude,
with the sword of depression in his right hand and the maul of rage in his left hand.
The final page of that issue with him standing there all charged up, and you've got the red coming down one side and the blue coming down the other, and he is just in all his glory. I mean, it's just still gives me goosebumps, you know, and the quote, "Try and stop me," you know, like, I mean, nobody could. Like, you know that there's not really anybody that could stand
yeah.
in front of him when he's one weapon. And now having two, it's just, wow. I mean, it took me to a yeah. whole other level on this when that happened.
Yeah, and like I said, it's Matt. And it's always Matt. You can always rely on him to give you those, like, comic book moments where you're like, oh, snap. Like, shit's about to get real.
Yeah. And so moving in here to the final issue of this arc, issue 15, we see that insanely overpowered Matt armed with the Sword of Grief and the Maul of Rage. And he is just marching through Angria, intent to kill Ash, while Angela and Chuck are, you know, essentially working to hack this machine in Glasstown that is building the die that are going to lead to the world's merging. And, you know, there's some cool panels here at the beginning where Isabel and Ash are seeing, like, explosions off in the distance, and they just know instinctively that this is Matt, and he is coming. And you see the dread and the worry kind of just go through the roof with Ash because everything is starting to fall apart. She's running out of answers. She's running out of plans. She is hanging on by a thread based on some of the limitations that have been put on her from her previous actions.
Yeah.
And so just everything's crumbling. And I mean, this book really, I think, pushes us to the edge of disaster before it took a few swerves that we're going to talk about here that ultimately I thought paid off really well.
Oh, I mean, this was an epic conclusion to a solid story arc. Like, just all the payoffs that you wanted, all of this, you know, chess piece maneuvering between Ash and Isabel and starting the war, and then the second party going off and getting the information, sneaking into, you know, the level 20 area of the die, breaking into the forge, sneaking around. All of this was just building, 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 and then the payoff was massive.
And it kind of gave me these, like, senses, especially with Ash. It almost made me think about, like, Cersei at the end of Game of Thrones, where she still had all this power, but nobody really wanted to be around her.
Yeah.
And everything, the walls were really closing in despite everything that she was trying. And, you know, just like Cersei, it's almost like she always had this way to weasel out of it.
Yeah.
I thought that it all coming to one big head in the palace was just maybe some of my favorite pages of comics that I've read ever, honestly.
You start to feel the true desperation of Ash.
Right.
You know, in how it's laid out and how it was delivered. You know, her and Isabel are on top of this peak and they're watching the explosions get closer and closer and closer. They know it's Matt. They know why he's here and they know what he wants to do. And they get torn in this, you know, kind of the overarching theme of this story is that she's seeing the damage he's doing to the city. And she knows that, like, he's killing real people out there. He's killing, you know, the damage that he's doing to Angria is going to be lasting. They learned that after their first trip and what they came back to. And so now she's torn, you know, do I save myself or do I save the people of this world? And I am their queen. This, you know, and it's a game, but it's not a game.
Yeah.
And so she makes the hard decisions and uses that massive spell to put the whole city to sleep.
Right. And pretty much makes it like, hey, Ash, we are going to deal with this, not anybody else, because we have put ourselves here.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, Matt kicks the doors in on the Citadel or the castle that they were in, and the fight that breaks down. And I'll let you get to that, where between Isabel kind of realizing that, you know, she's the last line of defense against this overpowered knight. She knows she can't win, but she has to do something.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome, because you see, yeah, he kicks in the door. He's now here. He is pretty much set that he is going to kill them both.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, one of the really cool pieces of art that we got out of this issue was Isabel calling in, you know, inspired by the fact that Matt is now dual wielding weapons. She kind of dual wields her own weapons by calling in two gods to form around her. And she becomes this like giant kind of phoenix bear,
yeah,
you know, on fire. And they have a few moments of fighting before, you know, Matt is still pretty much able to kind of take her out fairly easily, you know, doesn't kill her, but it's, you know, after maybe the first couple hits that Isabel gets in of offense, Matt pretty much just handles her, and the desperation just goes up even more for Ash. And I thought that what was really cool here, well, let me say this first, is that, you know, I don't know about you, but I wanted to ask, were you thinking that somebody was truly going to die from the party in this issue? Because for me, like, looking at the whole 15-issue run, we're in this really dark, terrible world, but none of our main characters had really been lost yet.
Yeah.
And so it just, that, I think that was one of the reasons why the tension was built up so high for me personally, was I was kind of like, it could be about time to lose somebody, and it could be really dramatic the way they were setting it up. So I don't know if you had those thoughts. So I want to hit that first before we kind of get into the final moments.
Oh, I absolutely did. You know, because it was time for that just emotional cash out. Like, really,
right,
I mean, we
right.
spent so much time with all of these people. They were going to, you know, break our hearts in some fashion. I didn't know who it was going to be. For a while, I thought it might be Chuck, because he does have this terminal illness, so he was maybe going to sacrifice himself.
Sure.
We saw some possibilities with Angela, because she wanted to trade her life with her daughter Molly, because that's kind of how it works with the Fallen. If the Fallen kill you, they take your place, yada yada. And then, but in this moment, I was like, man, this could be it. We could see Matt either coming in and Isabel taking one for the team, or maybe they get one over on Matt. I didn't know. I didn't think it was odd, because I didn't think it would be Ash, but at the exact same time, I thought it might be Ash.
Right, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
It's like a Rick Grimes situation, where you don't ever truly think Rick is going to die, because he is the quote-unquote main character, but he could.
Yeah,
you never know. You never know what direction they're going to take. So I very much, yeah, I think I was on the path that I thought someone was going to die.
Yeah, and you really think that Ash, even though we saw some of the moments early on in this arc, you know, he's still been fairly selfish. He's still been very much about what she wants, you know?
Yeah.
And so really, I thought was a really cool twist where they swapped it out, and kind of in the moments of everything really kind of closing in on her, being so selfish for the last, you know, 14 issues, we see her really take a different approach and kind of realize that something's got to give. You know, we've got to make some different choices. And so instead of necessarily doing the things that she could have to probably definitely end the fight or take over Matt or whatever it may be, she uses her dictator powers to save her son.
Yeah.
And kind of keep him away, because he wants to go fight Matt and fight for his mom and his queen. And I thought that was really just kind of an unexpected shift that helped bring Ash a little bit more back to the humanity and back to reality in a way, like what's important versus just playing this game.
Right. Well, and I think it's twofold, because it brings back the humanity of it all, but it also comes with a realization that it is a game and the rules are getting the better of her right now. Same situation with Wells and Bronte and all of these other characters who think they are controlling the game. And then they get that reality check that the game is actually controlling them. The game is pushing them. You know, you moved here, you moved there, but the game is going to fight back. And it is this moment where she has to make a commitment. It's either herself or others. And, you know, in the end, does the right thing, one could say, and gives up the lock that she has on Zamorna and protects someone else.
Well, and I think that's what made it so big, was that she knew that she was standing in front of somebody who wanted to kill her.
Yeah.
She's got enemy forces that want to kill her. And the whole lock she had over Zamorna to even give her the power of Angria was conditioned on her not being able to use her dictator powers on anybody else for any reason.
Yeah.
Because if she did, then she was going to release Zamorna, and they weren't friendly. You know, he did not like her, and she knew that he was probably going to come kill her as soon as he got the chance. And that was really, I think, kind of another aspect to it, was it wasn't a light decision, because she knew that things were just going to get worse for her. Even if she could survive Matt, she was then going to have to turn around and fight a very powerful NPC as well.
Yeah. Well, and it was in that moment that there was no escape, that she went back to Saul.
Yeah.
Which was just a touching moment. It's like, okay, realizing in the end, I want to go be with my best friend.
Right.
I want to go be with, if this is how it's going to go, you know, I'm going to go be with my best friend, and ultimately gets there and finds a possible way out of it all, which, you know, in the end is the final twist of the narrative.
Yeah. So Saul is in possession of one of what he thinks is the Grandmaster die. So the D20, he actually had installed it as one of his eyes, you know, and gave him a lot of power. And so in that desperate moment, Matt has pretty much defeated Isabel. Ash has now kept her son away. So, you know, Augustus isn't fighting Matt. And Saul pretty much rips out the D20 and gives it to Ash, thinking, you can become Grandmaster. Ash would be very powerful. And you kind of have that moment of like, what would this be like if Ash is now Grandmaster?
Yeah.
But that revelation that we get there that feeds into what we had mentioned earlier about somebody else pulling the strings, somebody else controlling the rules, is that, you know, Augustus and his ability to sense magic can tell that D20 actually has nothing magical about it. It's no better than like a wooden dreidel.
Yeah.
A toy.
It's a toy. And I think they straight call it out that it is a toy, that it holds no power.
Right.
And it's in that moment, everything comes crumbling down. Like all these things, all these pieces that you've set up just fall around you.
Well, and Saul immediately starts questioning himself, because he immediately realizes, well, if that had no power, how was I doing the things that I was able to do?
Yeah.
You know, because originally you kind of get the impression that a lot of the power is built around that D20, and now seemingly none of it was.
So someone clearly was allowing him to do that and letting him perceive that he was in control.
Exactly.
Which I imagine all great dungeon masters do.
Yeah, right? We got to make sure Alex doesn't get any thoughts here and make our lives even more hell when we get back into our campaign.
Yeah, right. He's read this, so yikes.
That's true. He has read it. All of this is really just happening and getting thrown at the reader.
Yeah.
Page after page in this issue. I mean, it's just start to finish, turning it up to 11, you know, keeping you on the edge of your seat. I could not stop reading. I mean, I was just page to page. Holy shit, what is about to happen?
Oh, yeah, you're burning through it. You got to know.
Right. And so, you know, while these conversations with Saul's happening, this revelation about the Grandmaster die is happening, Matt is pretty much still kind of pushing in on the room. And we know now, like, they show it that Zamorna is on his way back to immediate, like, he left the battlefield. He does not care about his armies anymore. He's coming back to, I think he said in the book, feast on sluttish blood.
Yeah.
Or something like that, you know? And it was really kind of funny little moment, little quote. But in the sense of everything that's happening, Ash is finally able to just barely get through to Matt and kind of say to him, hey, you know, your father didn't raise a murderer. And I mean, my freaking eyes popped out of my skull reading this moment, because in that moment he stops, he agrees with her, and he says, no, but my friends made me a murderer. And he turns just as Zamorna is coming in, and he slices him in half from skull to ass, straight down the middle.
Yeah.
And my jaw hit the floor, man. I was like, wow. Like, bravo to the writers. I mean,
yeah.
Perfect.
Well, and then the line delivery, because we'd had so many flips of allegiances and flips of, like, kind of character personality traits where
yes.
Ash was being very selfish, and then in the end ends up kind of being selfless. And then Matt on the other end, who was with a party trying to do something very selfless for the entire world, gets the news that his father's dying and says, I'm really sorry, but I've got to go do this for myself. And abandons, you know, Angela and Chuck in their quest to break the forge, and which ultimately, when we'll get to it, has repercussions. But you're right, that specific moment where, you know, his flip of personality is like, you're right, you know, this is who I am, but this is what this world has created in me.
Yes.
And it all plays back into the dichotomy of who you are in real life, who you are in Die. And those mirroring images, but sometimes blurred images. Yeah, but the specific spot panel where he flips around, cuts Zamorna in half, and then follows it up with a massive maul slash, like,
right,
you know, basically
yeah.
cuts him in half with one arm and the sword, follows it up with the maul and just drives him into the ground. It is like, holy crap.
Yeah, and I mean, Zamorna, from everything they've shown us, is not a weak entity. He's a vampire, you know?
Yeah.
And Matt just easily dices him, you know? It was just like, holy crap, man. But it was wild. It was a great way to bring the party back together in still fractured and probably mending way. But to your point, kind of showing both sides that neither is kind of perfect in their moral compass or their decision-making. You know, both sides have been selfish and selfless, and there's a lot of gray area there. But it does ultimately wrap up with Chuck and Angela not being able to stop the forge, partly because of Matt leaving, partly because of that struggle between Angela and her daughter Molly being an aspect there. And so the magical die start to get sent to the world, which will essentially keep this cycle going and bring about that merging of Earth and Die that is now kind of the big plot issue that the party has to deal with. And we see the entire party come together there at the Forge for the first time since the previous arcs. And man, the final page of this, the final words of this, where Matt essentially comes to the realization that they are all going to have to, quote, go down a fucking dungeon
yeah.
to help grab these die before they make it into Earth and save the world, essentially.
Yeah.
I need the new books now.
Yeah.
Like, if this world is as crazy as it is without being a dungeon.
Yeah.
And the party, Matt, and all his power, is scared, essentially, of dungeons or, you know, worried about them. I was like, where are we going next?
Yeah.
Like, what is about to happen in Arc 4?
Yeah, and it's interesting because I kind of got the vibe that we were headed to a finale of some kind with the world.
Possible.
Like, it is, you know, headed in this direction where we've built this world, we've destroyed this world, we've redeemed this world. Now we need to save everyone. And so I will be very interested to see kind of what happens, you know, moving forward in this space, in this die realm. But you're right, like, yeah, the next arc, going into the dungeon and dealing with whatever's in there, could be wild.
Yeah, I expect more combat. I expect things to be turned up even more. And maybe it'll be there that we'll lose a party member or two. Like we were kind of expecting going into the end of this one.
Yeah.
But I had the same questions, you know, how long is Die going to run? Like, will that create a natural wrap-up point if they get through the dungeon by the end of Arc 4? Maybe we get two arcs that's essentially the entire dungeon.
Well, I do know, if you want to know.
Sure.
It is ending at 20.
Oh, okay. So it is going to be one more arc.
Yeah, one more arc, and then it is going to... They announced it actually just 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
Issue 16 hasn't come out yet, but I think it's due out in the next week or so at the time of recording, so it should be out before the end of April 2021. But then the entire series is going to end before the end of the year. Which seems very fitting in some aspects that it's going to end with number 20.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's going to be disappointing because it has been so good from moment one. You know, I think that was kind of one of my wrap-up thoughts here is now reading three story arcs from them. Every arc has been on par with each other. You know, they set the bar so high in the first arc that you would have thought that it had been really hard to live up to it after just creating such great worlds, creating such great characters. And no, I mean, arc two, just as good. Arc three, just as good. Maybe you can argue about which one is really the best out of all of them, but man, it's like, to me, they are, you know, 1A, 1B, 1C right now. And you just don't see that all the time from comics.
No, it just, they all build on top of each other. And I think when it's all said and done, it's going to be one long story. Like, you're not going to be able to divide it up. You're going to need to read when you go to sit down, you're going to want to blitz 1 through 20. You're not going to just go pick out and read just volume 3 or just volume 2.
Right.
You're going to want the full gamut, you know, of all issues.
Yeah, well, when we come back at some point in the future, because I imagine we will absolutely cover, you know, especially if it's the finale now, it'll be interesting to see what our thoughts are as far as, you know, do we want more? Like, or are we cool with how it ends? Because I think I could read this for years to come if they were to keep a die type story going along. But if it ends and ends up being this gem, then I guess I'll be okay with that. But you've already kind of got me teetering on the yaboo of hearing that it's supposed to end, because it's probably my favorite comic out right now.
I can leave you with a high note, and that Kieran Gillian is developing, and it's already out there. You can play it. The beta version is there. A actual RPG version of Die.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
So there's a handbook, there's character sheets, there's rules. You know, people are playing it, actively playing it right now. So that's kind of what I see being the next step of this evolution is, yeah, maybe the story of this party of six, you know, Ash and Angela, Matt, Chuck, Isabel, and Salt, that ends. But you then get to go experience the world of Dai on your own through the RPG game.
So what you're telling me is that once we're done with our current D&D campaign, this is what we're going to move to for our next one.
I could very much see that happening.
We might have to.
Well, Die continues to deliver with unexpected narrative twists and turns, as well as layers upon layers of world and character development. It's no wonder that it's already won a Hugo Award for Best Graphic Story in 2020 and was named as a finalist again in 2021. Hit us up on social media to let us know if you've been reading Die or if you've got any other comic recommendations for us to talk about in the future. Lastly, if you've enjoyed this comic discussion, then check out some of our back catalog. Chapters 1, 8, 13, 18, and 30 are all solid places to hear us break down various comic stories.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this chapter, be sure to hit the subscribe button to get new chapters of Geek Ketchup every 2 weeks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Be sure to follow the show on social media, and you can find us on Facebook and YouTube at Geek Ketchup Podcast, or on Twitter and Instagram at Geek Ketchup Pod. Links to all these accounts are in the show notes below and on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. Stay saucy, you nerds.